So I am a postdoctoral fellow at the Drexel University School of Public Health, and I'm going to talk to you about autism, risk communication, and ethics today. In the short amount of time I have, a synoptic view of the issues isn't going to be possible, so what I'd like to do instead is to sort of hone down on a couple issues that I think are important and under-discussed. And I'm going to start off talking a little bit about harm reduction or prevention, and then I'm going to ask the question of whether we should actually communicate risk actively even in circumstances where we have it well characterized. I'd like to briefly just acknowledge that my postdoctoral fellowship is funded by a medical academic partnership grant from Pfizer, for which I'm grateful to them. I don't perceive any material conflict of interest, but I wanted to err on the safe side and let you guys know. And I'd like to acknowledge my collaborator, Michael Udell. Michael couldn't be here today, but he did help me construct the presentation. So this is in-progress work. We haven't published it or written it up yet. If you guys have any constructive criticism, we'd appreciate it. Briefly, I'd like to thank Drs. Craig Neuschafer and Seth Wells, both epidemiologists at Drexel, who have been helpful in interpreting the literature on autism risks, particularly the genetic risk data, which can get kind of complicated. And I just want to briefly acknowledge the value judgments and implicit in health and disease categorizations. Anytime you talk about risk, you presuppose that there's a harmful outcome you want to avoid, in this case, the harmful outcome being an autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. But, you know, reasonable questions can be and have been asked about whether all phenotypes currently acknowledged as being on the spectrum really ought to be regarded as disorders or diseases as opposed to just differences. And I'm not going to talk about that, but I do want to acknowledge my sensitivity to it. Now, briefly, I'd like to go through some background on ASDs. This is going to be very kind of fast in general. ASDs are part of the pervasive developmental disorders and include autistic disorder, Asperger disorder, and pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, or PDD-NOS. Autistic disorder is characterized by deficits in social interaction and communication, as well as a pattern of repetitive or stereotypic behavior and restricted interests. And in contradistinction to autistic disorder, which is accompanied by intellectual disability in approximately 40% of cases, Asperger disorder is characterized by average to above average cognition and no language delay. PDD-NOS is characterized by deficits in social interaction, but the pattern in this domain or the other two domains isn't consistent with the diagnosis of either autistic or Asperger disorder. Parenthetically, I will note that the classification scheme is going to change somewhat with DSM-5 due out in 2013. A lot of these are going to get rolled under a category of autism spectrum disorder along with something else called childhood disintegrative disorder. And that raises its own set of ethical issues. I won't be talking about them today. Now, why should public health care about ASDs? Well, for starters, the prevalence is increasing from about 5 per 10,000 in the 60s and 70s. Current estimates vary and are as high as 172 per 10,000. The reasons for the increase aren't entirely understood. It could be a true increase in prevalence, maybe due to changes in the application of diagnostic criteria, for example, diagnostic substitution for other disorders, increased attention paid to the disorder by the medical community, or some combination of these, although the emerging consensus seems to be that at least some of the apparent increase is real. ASDs can significantly impact the welfare of affected individuals and their families, and they're associated with significant costs. It's been estimated that it'll cost about $35 billion to care for all individuals diagnosed with an ASD each year over the course of their lifetime, and that works out to about $3 million per person. Now, with respect to the etiology of ASDs, the two themes I'd like to emphasize are complexity and uncertainty. We know that ASDs are substantially heritable, but the number attached to this varies. For a long time, it was 60 to 90% based on some twin studies that were done in the 90s. There's a recent large twin study published earlier this year that reported under 50% heritability for both a strict and broad autism phenotype. However, this is when considering ASDs as a whole in about 5 to 15% of cases, usually called syndromic cases. There's a known genetic cause. There's also been some recent research that's identified some sort of putative novel monogenic causes in cases that would have formerly been classified as idiopathic, such as a micro duplication syndrome at chromosome 15q11-13, or mutations in the SHANK3 gene at chromosome 22. However, in many cases, perhaps even in most cases, it looks like we're dealing with a polygenic etiology, with individual genes exerting small to moderate causal effects, and with gene environment interactions being likely. Furthermore, there's presently existing uncertainty regarding the replicability of individual studies reporting specific risk factors, regarding the specificity of risk factors for a particular ASD phenotype, or even for ASDs in general versus schizophrenia or ADHD or intellectual disability, regarding the exact causal contribution of various genes, and then regarding which specific environmental risk factors might be involved, although a handful of candidates have been identified. So the upshot is that this is a complicated picture for risk communication, whether we're talking about to individual, you know, patients or families in the clinical genetic setting or to the general public through more institutional channels. And I think for a short presentation, the best way to look at this is to look at some examples to see how some difficulties could arise. So a recent case control study published in 2011 found that SSRI used by mothers during pregnancy, particularly during the first trimester, was associated with approximately twice the risk of developing an ASD. However, the risk difference between the two groups was small at about 3%. So in response to learning this information, a pregnant woman may choose to forego antidepressant use with either no ill effects or significant ill effects to her, and this choice may or may not ultimately make a difference as to whether her child develops an ASD. Pregnant women who choose to take antidepressants, knowing this risk, may feel anxious about their child's health, while mothers of a child with an ASD who took antidepressants during pregnancy may feel guilty if they believe that they've caused their child's ASD. Pregnant women taking antidepressants may be stigmatized if others find out, and this outcome may be particularly likely in light of the legacy of mother blame that we see with autism. And finally, even women who aren't taking antidepressants may experience greater anxiety just due to sort of spillover effects, where knowledge about autism risk from antidepressants sort of makes you more sensitive to environmental risks in general. As a second example, consider the possibility that chromosomal microarray testing, or CMA, currently recommended as a first-line test in a diagnostic workup of ASDs, becomes implemented as an early detection tool for ASDs before a firm clinical diagnosis could be made. Now, in the best-case scenario, the detection of a determinative risk factor enables early diagnosis, early intervention, and hopefully better outcomes. However, the detection of a risk factor of unknown causal significance or known but small causal significance may result in the child being placed under a magnifying glass and subsequently given a diagnosis that they don't merit, or in parents devoting resources to autism-related interventions that are not needed. Now, finally, learning about risk information may prompt individuals to take subsequent action that's either too precautionary or perhaps not considerate enough of other risks. For example, parents of a child with an ASD may have CMA testing performed on themselves, and after this test turns up a genetic variant of small causal contribution, decide to have not have another child because they believe they will give their child an ASD. Alternatively, parents of a young child who receive CMA testing revealing a similar variant of small causal contribution may pay less attention to environmental risk than they otherwise would, believing that their child definitely will develop an ASD, and then environmental risk avoidance won't make a difference. So while the preceding examples are sketchy and by no means exhaustive, they suggest to me that autism risk communication could result in a variety of adverse outcomes ranging from anxiety to guilt to stigma to individuals taking actions that aren't ultimately in their interests. Now, such adverse outcomes may or may not be due to misunderstanding of information. Even where so, they could be predictable and understandable because probabilistic information can be difficult to understand, particularly where you're dealing with causality that's not necessary nor sufficient. Now, it seems unlikely that we could ever conduct risk communication in a way that assures no possibility of harm, but arguably we ought to try to minimize harm to the extent that we're able. How might we do this? Well, one approach is to make risk information as comprehensible to message recipients as is possible, and historically, a large amount of scholarship regarding risk communication is focused on comprehensibility. From an ethical standpoint, the approach has the advantage of promoting individuals' autonomous choice at the same time as it reduces adverse outcomes, so it's not particularly controversial for that reason. However, this approach alone seems unlikely to resolve all concerns about risk communication and harm, where the causal contribution of autism risk being communicated is neither sufficient nor necessary. It may be more difficult for risk communicators to ensure adequate understanding. Prior experience with risk communication regarding complex genetic disorders such as type 2 diabetes mellitus supports this supposition. Some harmful outcomes such as stigmatization arguably don't depend on message recipients' understanding of risk information or their lack thereof. And support mechanisms for enhancing individual understanding and also minimizing anxiety and guilt, such as genetic counseling, don't seem like they're going to be feasible within the context of broader public health communication campaigns. So a second strategy also used to enhance the efficacy of risk communication is to modify the target of a risk message or the timing of the message. And you can also try to use this to minimize harm. This strategy, too, may be helpful in minimizing inadvertent harm, but it's unclear whether we can do this without any trade-offs. For example, CMA testing could be restricted to situations where there's a strong clinical index of suspicion that a child has an ASD. And doing this may decrease false positive diagnoses, but it also would preclude the use of CMA as an early detection tool, for example, in the perinatal period. Similarly, the communication of ASD risk associated with SSRI antidepressants could be restricted to the clinical setting, where physicians prescribing SSRIs would be relied upon as the main risk communicators. This approach may help to decrease generalized risk anxiety as compared to a broader public health risk communication campaign, but it may miss women who are already taking SSRIs when they become pregnant. And since the first OBGYN visit is typically around 8 weeks, and the risk associated with SSRIs is highest during the first trimester, this may not be an insignificant problem. So it doesn't seem like there's any easy fixes there. And finally, the targeting of a high-risk group to enhance efficacy and minimize harm may raise ethical concerns relating to justice, in as much as lower-risk groups may still desire that information and find it relevant. For example, communication of autism risk around organophosphate pesticides may target primarily rural communities, but to the extent that other communities are also exposed, they may risk communicators may still have obligations to provide this information to them. Okay. So the preceding two strategies have presumed that we are going to communicate a particular risk and have sort of asked how we can minimize harm given that. And what I'd like to do now is raise the question of in situations outside of informed consent, when we're looking at sort of broad public health risk communication, or potentially even in the clinical genetic setting, whether we should communicate all risk even when we have it well characterized. Traditional models of rationality and risk-related decision-making have tended to assume that all possible harms, every probability of harm, is relevant to a decision. So they assume that a decision-maker should pay attention to all risks, even if they later decide not to do anything about a particular risk. But of course, human beings are not and can never be computers capable of processing an infinite amount of information. And the practical upshots of trying to factor every risk into one's decision-making process likely include chronic anxiety, hypervigilance, or simply cognitive fatigue. Furthermore, some philosophers and sociologists have argued that the concept of risk inherently involves an implication of moral responsibility, and it seems untenable to think that individual actors are responsible for every probability of harm. So if this line of argument is correct, and I think that there's at least some provisional reason to think it might be, then a rational actor need not take into account every risk or every probability of harm, and the possibility that some risk information may simply not be useful or relevant to message recipients, coupled with the possibility that communicating such information may still lead to harm, suggests that in some circumstances we should not actively initiate risk communication. Now, the difficulties here, of course, lie in determining which risks are relevant, and to ethical tension, perhaps even an obligation to disclose risks and a desire, also perhaps an obligation to minimize harm. Now, very little has been written about risk relevance. I suggest that the relevance of a risk depends on at least four factors, although there may be more. First, risk information that can provide meaningful explanation or other psychological benefit seems relevant. For example, revealing that a genetic variant arose de novo and was not transmitted by parents to a child with an ASD may make them feel less guilty, regardless of whether transmitting an inherited variant ought to make them feel guilty. Second, the relevance of a risk is supported by our ability to take meaningful action in response to it. Meaningful action may, of course, include risk avoidance and mitigation, but it also might include making other life decisions differently in response to learning about a significant unavoidable risk. I think the paradigm example here being Huntington's disease. Third, the overall magnitude of a risk seems to bear upon whether someone need worry about it. Historically, risk managers have used the concept of de minimis risk to represent a probability threshold past which risks might reasonably be ignored. And this concept is vulnerable to philosophical criticism insofar as probability is not the only relevant determinant of risk magnitude. Nonetheless, that a risk is a very small probability is one consideration bearing upon its relevance. Similarly, an outcome of questionably bad value is prima facie less relevant from the standpoint of risk communicators than an outcome of significant and unquestionable badness. And finally, I don't have it up on the slide here, but the cost of avoiding an outcome obviously seems relevant. Even small risks may be relevant for risk communicators when individuals can avoid them with little or no cost, right? But a significant cost for avoiding a small risk seems to make it less relevant from the standpoint of risk communicators. So some of these concerns have been raised by risk-cost-benefit analysis or expected utility theory, but of course these approaches don't filter risks by relevance. And furthermore, contrary to those approaches, I think it seems unlikely that a philosophically defensible algorithm, you know, could be determined for figuring out which risks are relevant. Assuming, for the sake of argument, that not all risks are relevant, the key question is whether reasonable persons might come to agreement about which risks fall into this category. Hard cases should be expected, but it seems relevant to suppose, again, that very small probability risks that can't be avoided may fall into the category of not relevant, to consider just one example. And it seems likely, particularly from the genetic standpoint, that a lot of the information we're going to uncover actually will fall into that box. Relevance is a value-laden moral determination, so if risk communicators refrain from communicating all known risks on grounds of relevance, it seems prudent to set a pretty high bar for the degree of critical scrutiny and stakeholder involvement that should go into such decisions. Finally, there are more complicated ethical issues at which I can only gesture here. For example, a given piece of risk information may be of small causal significance, but multiple such risks may sum, of course, to a significant risk profile, which suggests that the relevance of a risk can't be determined in isolation from other risks, and it may change as we learn more risk information over the next, let's say, 5 years. Finally, whether individuals have a positive right to the provision of all known risk information will determine the ethical defensibility of withholding it. Where risk information may be judged relevant by a rational actor, the harm-benefit profile from a public health standpoint of communicating that may still be unfavorable, but as relevance increases, it seems more difficult to justify a paternalistic stance of withholding that information. So I'm going to stop there. I have one more slide on evidential standards and risk and value judgments there. If anybody is interested in that issue, you can come talk to me afterwards. Thanks.